McKendrick and Angus went out, and the guard closed the door behind them.
"Look," said McKendrick, dragging Angus into one side room after another. "Machines, machines, machines. This was once a very well-appointed and outfitted hospital. Those big things over there, I've seen them in an ancient book, were called X-ray machines. It was a subject called radiology."
"Radiation?" said Angus.
"No, man, not on Johnny. Radiation is for killing cyclos. You're daft. Those machines let you look inside the body and find out what is wrong. They were invaluable."
"Those machines," said Angus angrily, "were run by electricity. Why do you think we like this place with mine lamps?"
"You must get them running," said McKendrick.
"Even if I did, I see by that one they have tubes. The gas in those tubes is over 1,000 years old. We can't get any more of it, and couldn't get it into the tubes if we had any. You're daft, man."
McKendrick glared at him.
"There is something pressing on his brain. I can't just go plunging into it with a scalpel. I can't guess. Not with Johnny McTyler. People would slaughter me."
"You want to see inside his head?" said Angus. "Well, why didn't you say so?"
Angus went off muttering about electricity. He told a standby pilot at the heliport that he needed to get to the compound fast. The pilots were very few, and they were being run ragged. They were zipping off to all parts of the world. They had a sort of international airline going that was beginning to visit every remaining pocket of men on the planet at least once a week. They were ferrying World Federation coordinators and chiefs and tribal leaders as fast as they could. More pilots were in training, but right now they only had 30 plus the two in hospital. So a casual request, even from a Scot, even from a member of the original combat force, was not likely to get much heed. Travel from the underground base to the compound was usually by ground car. Angus told him it had to do with Johnny, and the pilot said why hadn't he said so, and pushed him into the plane, and said he would wait for him to come back. With grim purpose, Angus went to the compound section where they kept the captive cyclos. A small area of the old dormitory level had been rigged to circulate breathe gas, and unreconstructed cyclos were there under heavy guard. They numbered about 60 now, for occasional ones were brought here from distant mine sites when they surrendered peacefully. Turl was captive elsewhere. Angus got an air mask, and the Scot guard let him in. The place was very dim, and the huge cyclos sat around in attitudes of despair. One didn't walk in the place without being covered by the guard. The prisoners expected a cyclo counterattack, and were not too cooperative. The Scot engineer located Care and dug him out of his apathy. He demanded of Care to tell him whether he knew of any mining equipment that would let one look through solid objects. Care shrugged. Angus told him who it was for, and Care sat there for a while, his amber eyes thoughtful. Then suddenly he wanted to be reassured as to who this was for, and Angus told him it was for Johnny. Care was turning a tiny gold band around in his claws. Suddenly, he sprang up and demanded that Angus give him an escort and a breathe mask. Care went down to the shops, and in a storeroom there dug up a strange machine. He explained it was used to analyze the internal structure of mineral samples and to find crystalline cracks inside metals. He showed Angus how to work it. You put the emanation tube under the object to be examined, and you read the results on the top screen. There was also a trace paper reader that showed metals in alloys or rocks. It worked on some wavelength he called subproton field emanation, and this was intensified by the lower tube, and the influence went through the sample and you read it on the top screen. Being cyclo, it was quite massive, and Care carried it for him to the waiting plane. A guard took Care back, and Angus returned to the military base. They tried it with some cats they had that were cleaning the rat population out, and the cats afterward seemed cheerful enough. The screen showed the skull outline very nicely. They tried it on one of the wounded Scots who volunteered, and they found a piece of stone in his hand from a mine injury, and he too seemed fine afterward. About 4 o'clock that afternoon they used it on Johnny. By 4:30 they had a three-dimensional picture and the trace paper.
A very relieved Dr. McKendrick pointed it out to Angus. A piece of metal? See it? A sliver just below one of the trephine holes.
Well, we'll just get him ready, and I can have that out with a scalpel soon enough.
Metal? Said Angus.
Scalpel? On Johnny? No, you don't. Don't you dare touch him. I'll be right back.
With the metal trace paper flying behind him, Angus, 15 minutes later, charged in on the Chamco brothers. They worked in a separate breathe gas dome at the compound, industriously trying to assist Robert the Fox to put things back together. Angus shoved the trace under their pug nose bones.
What metal is this?
The Chamcos examined the trace squiggles.
Ferristamonite, they said. A very strong support alloy.
Is it magnetic?
Demanded Angus. And they said yes, of course it was. By 6 o'clock, Angus was back in the hospital. He had a heavy electro coil he had just made. It had hand grips on it. Angus showed McKendrick how to guide it, and McKendrick worked out the best path to bring the sliver out with the least damage to tissue. A few minutes later, they had the broad sliver in their hands, withdrawn by the magnet. Later, the Chamco brothers identified it with closer analysis as a piece of a battle plane skid strut,
which has to be very strong and very light.
Johnny had not been conscious enough to tell anyone what he had done on the drone, and Chrissy had shooed off the historian when he tried to find out earlier. So it was a bit of a mystery as to how a sliver piece of a strut could have been daggered into Johnny's head. But whatever they had done to him, Chrissy was extremely relieved. The fever he had dropped, his breathing improved, and his color got better. The following morning he came out of the coma and smiled a little at Chrissy and McKendrick and dropped into a natural sleep. Planetary radio was not slow in crackling with the news. There Johnny was out of danger. The pipe major paraded his pipes and drums all around the compound on the heels of the crier who was yelling it out to work parties. Bonfires blazed both there and in various other parts of the world, and a coordinator in the Andes relayed the news that the chiefs of some peoples they had found there had declared this an annual celebration day, and could they come now and pay homage? A pilot standing by with his plane in the mountains of the moon in Africa had to get help from both coordinators and chiefs of that small colony in order to get space to take off again, so mobbed had the field become with celebrating jubilant people. The compound radio operators had to double up on shifts to handle the message traffic roaring in on them as a result of the announcement. Robert the Fox just went around grinning at everybody. 3. As the days wore on into weeks, it became obvious to the council, originally composed of the parson, the schoolmaster, the historian, and Robert the Fox, and now augmented by several clan chiefs, who left deputies in Scotland, that Johnny was brooding about something. He would smile at them from his bed and talk to them when spoken to, but there was something deep in his eyes that was dull and moody. Chrissy tried not to let them come very often, and when they did, she was a bit impatient with them if they overstayed. Some of the Russians and some Swedes were rebuilding parts of the academy due to the desperate need for pilots. Until the ancient Capitol building in Denver could be rebuilt, the council had a room at the academy. They could get to both the compound and the underground military base from there, and all their berthing quarters were there. At this particular meeting, Robert the Fox was walking up and down, his kilt flaring out each time he turned, his claymore held snug enough by an ancient officer's belt from the base, which also held a Smith & Wesson, knocking against chairs.
Something is bothering him. He is not like the old Johnny.
Does he think we are doing something wrong? Said the chief of Clan Fergus.
No, no, it isn't that, said Robert the Fox.
There's not a scrap of criticism for anyone in his makeup.
It's just he seems worried.
The parson cleared his throat.
It just could be his side has something to do with it. He cannot much move his right arm, and he cannot walk as yet. He is, after all, used to being about and very briskly as well. After all, the lad had a dreadful time of it, all alone, injured. I can't think how he managed. all that time in a cage earlier? You're all expecting too much too fast, gentlemen. He has a brave spirit, and I have faith.
Could be worry over the possibility of a cyclo counterattack, said the chief of Clan Argyle.
We must reassure him somehow, said the chief of Clan Fergus. Heaven knows we are working hard enough on planetary affairs.
And they were. The World Federation for the Unification of the Human Race had been formed from those Johnny had not accepted for the group that had come with him to America. Some 200 young Scots and another 50 oldsters had done their beginning work well. In two dangerous but successful raids, one to the site of an ancient university named Oxford and another to a similar ruin at Cambridge, they had obtained language books and a mound of material on other countries. They had worked out where isolated groups of humans might still be and had formed up a unit for each language they thought might still be in use. Their selection was proving not far off, and ruler bruised hands attested to the diligence of their study. They called themselves coordinators, and they were making a vital contribution all over the world where groups were being found. The current estimate was that there were nearly 35,000 human beings left on Earth, an astonishing number that, the Council agreed, was far too great for any one town. The groups were mostly survivors who had withdrawn to mountainous places, natural fortresses their forebears had mined, as in the case of the Rockies. But some were in the frozen north, in which the cyclos had had no interest, and some were simply overlooked strays. The duty of the council, as they saw it, was to preserve the tribal and local customs and government, and install over all of it a clan system, appointing local leaders as clan chiefs. The coordinators spread the news and were extremely welcome and successful. The hard-worked pilots were ferrying in chiefs and visitors and simply anyone who got on their passenger planes. If there were too many going or coming, they simply told them to wait until next week, and that was fine. But there was no really organized forward motion. Local control of the tribes was often slack. Some had retained literacy in their language, some had not. Most of them were poor, half-starved, ragged. The one incredible fact that after over 1,000 years there was freedom from cyclos, even if possibly temporary, united them in a wave of hope. They had once gazed from their mountains on the ruins of cities they dared not visit. They had looked upon fertile plains and great herds they dared not benefit from. They had seen no hope whatever for their dying race. And then, suddenly, men from the sky, speaking their language, telling them of the remarkable feats that led to possible freedom, had brought them soaring hope and reburgeoning pride in their race. The Council's existence they accepted. They joined it, and, with radios parked on rocks and in huts, communicated with it. They all had one question. Was the Johnny McTyler, of whom the coordinator spoke, a part of this council? Yes, he was. Good. No more questions. But the council well knew that Johnny was not an active part of the council now. Completely aside from the political significance of it, every council member was himself personally concerned for Johnny. There were all kinds of things happening over the world, most of the actions taken without even informing the council. People were moving about. A group of South Americans with baggy pants and flat leather hats, swinging wide lariats and riding almost as well as Johnny once did, had suddenly walked off a plane with their women and lariats and saddles and said, through their Spanish-speaking Scot coordinator, that they were llaneros, or gauchos, and they knew cattle, but would find out what to do with buffalo, and were taking over the management of the vast herds to preserve them and make sure the people at the compound and base were properly fed. Two Italians from the Italian Alps had shown up and taken over the commissary after making peace with the old women. 5 Germans from Switzerland had shown up and opened a factory in Denver to salvage and service man equipment such as knives and tools, you name it, and if you sent it to them, they would make it shiny and working and send it back. This put a freight line into an already overburdened pilot zone. 3 Basques showed up and simply started making shoes. The difficulty was that Basque as a language had been omitted by the coordinators, and the shoemakers were learning English and cyclo while they turned out shoes from the hides the South Americans dedicatedly furnished them. The others came in. Everybody wanted to help and simply helped.
There is no control of it, Robert the Fox told Johnny one day in the hospital room.
Johnny simply gave him a small smile and said, Why control them? The historian, except for Johnny's account of the drone, which was too sketchy to be called history, was getting bogged down in assembling tribal histories of the last 1,000 or more years. The coordinators sent him all kinds of stuff, and he couldn't even keep it in order. Some serious-eyed Chinese from a mountain fastness there had shown up to help him, and they were furiously studying English, but were not of much help yet. It seemed at first that language would be an obstacle, but it soon became clear that the future educated person would speak three languages: cyclo for technical matters, English for arts, humanities, and government, and their own tribal language, if not English. The pilots chattered cyclo at each other. All their equipment was in cyclo, as well as their manuals and navigation and related skills. There was a lot of protest at speaking the language of the hated cyclos, until the historian learned that cyclo as a language was really a composite of words and technical developments stolen from other peoples in the universes, and there never had been a basic language called cyclo. People were glad of that, and thereafter learned it more willingly, but they liked to refer to it as techno. The parson had his own problems. He had about 40 different religions on his hands. They had one thing in common, the myths of the conquest 1,000 or more years ago. Otherwise, they were miles apart. He had witch doctors and medicine men and priests and such flooding his doorstep. He knew very well the wars that can develop out of different faiths, and he was not going to evangelize any one of them. Man wanted peace. He explained to them that man, being divided and internally at war, had advanced too slowly as a culture, and so had been wide open to an invasion from elsewhere. They all agreed man should not be at war with man. The myths, well, they knew the truth of it now. They were happy to abandon those myths. But on this question of which gods and which devils were valid, well, the parson had neatly handled the whole thing for the moment. He would disturb no beliefs at all. Every one of these tribes was demanding to know what was the religion of Johnny McTyler. Well, he wasn't really of any religion, the parson told them. He was Johnny McTyler. Instantly and without exception, Johnny McTyler became part of their religions. And that was that. But Johnny was lying a bit wan, trying each day at Chrissy's and McKendrick's persuasion to walk, to use his arm. And when the parson tried to tell him he was getting woven into the pantheon of about 40 religions, he said nothing. He just lay there, not much life or interest showing in the depths of his eyes. The council was not having a happy time of it.